It's pictograph. It's picture writing, you see? So you have somebody, you depict them running. You depict someone rowing a boat. And there are little tricks that could be introduced to indicate whether it's happening right now, whether it will happen tomorrow, or whether it happened yesterday. But in any case, hieroglyphic would be very inefficient to use. So what began to happen was the emergence of a demotic, that is to say, a popular script that could be used more widely read, more widely made, more widely produced, put on papyrus sheets, and then preserved. Now, we could turn to other aspects of Egyptian culture, for example, the desire to keep bodies intact. You got to have some place for the ka to go back to. So if you keep bodies for the afterlife, if you're going to preserve them, then obviously in the process of preserving them, you're going to learn a very great deal about the human body. The Egyptians then discovered that not only could you do things to cadavers, to dead bodies, you could do things to live bodies. So they became precocious, for example, in surgery. They developed a knowledge of anatomy that was second to none in all of antiquity. What then are we to make of the legacy of Egypt? It's a bit puzzling in a way. The Greeks and the Romans were impressed. They were dazzled by the Egyptians. They remembered them. They wrote about them. They were extremely curious about them. Egypt attracted a great many visitors in antiquity. But it's not so easy to see exactly just what influence Egypt actually had. For example, Egypt's political control in the New Kingdom lasted for a very brief time. Divinized kingship, as the Egyptians practiced, did recur historically, but I don't think it recurred, strictly speaking, because of the Egyptians. The Egyptians didn't really give us any new literary forms. There's nothing in Egypt as good as Gilgamesh. There's a lot of wonderful poetry. There's nothing new. The Egyptians, having much stone available, built magnificent temples, built the pyramids, as we've seen. Building huge architecture as propaganda is, again, something that has recurred, but this isn't, strictly speaking, Egyptian. We didn't need the Egyptians to invent it. Now, the earliest Egyptologists from the middle of the 19th century on were very anxious to claim ancient Egypt for the West. It's always been, I think, in some ways, kind of a dubious proposition whether Egypt is part of the West. And then the whole issue was given a new spur of influence in the years after the Second World War. With the crumbling of colonial empires, and particularly in North America, the emergence of black consciousness, some people claimed that Egypt was particularly, specifically, an African civilization. Now this, of course, spawned then a claim, no, it's not, it's Western. Africa is something different. But can one actually equate Egypt and Africa? That is a very controversial view. In its most extreme form, people will have said that, some people argued, that Western civilization was stolen from the Egyptians by the Greeks, and that in fact, therefore, it was Egyptian in the first place and African behind that. Now that view, again, puts a very sharp focus on Egypt, but perhaps without solid reasons for doing so, and perhaps by way of indicating that modern interests in Egypt have been rather more prominent than ancient interests in Egypt. It is, therefore, a mystery. Just what it is we have learned from, gotten from, borrowed from the Egyptians. That just might explain the mysterious smile of the Sphinx.
Lecture 4, The Hebrews, Small States and Big Ideas.
Hello again, and welcome to the fourth of our lectures on the foundations of Western civilization. You may remember that yesterday, last time, we talked about Egypt. And in the concluding remarks to that lecture, I observed that the Egyptians have been perhaps more important for how they have been remembered than for what they did. Well, in some very real ways, we're going to turn to two little peoples today, the Phoenicians and the Hebrews, who likewise are important for how they are remembered, but also for certain things that they did, yet not because they built great empires, not because they were great conquerors, not because they were particularly gifted in the arts, but because, particularly with the Hebrews, of a profound religious tradition. Now, these small peoples Egyptians and Hittites, having worn themselves out, as we saw, in this long series of wars that they fought with one another, these small peoples were able to emerge. There was a kind of a gap, an interstice, that runs from, let's say, about 1200 B.C. to about 700 B.C. And in that period of time, a number of small states emerged. Some of these really don't need to attract much of our attention. We might say, for example, that this is the time of the Philistines. Contemporary records speak of sea peoples, a group of peoples who sort of raided and invaded all along the eastern coast of the Mediterranean and the southern shore of the Mediterranean as well, particularly around Egypt. But these were not people who left any durable impact, who made any long-term contributions. The Phoenicians, on the other hand, are rather different. So let's spend just a few minutes thinking about them. Reminding yourselves again that these were a very small people who had an opportunity to emerge because, for a moment, their great and powerful neighbors had been much weakened. Now, the Phoenicians, actually, they're Canaanites. They're people who live roughly in what is today Lebanon, the area north of what we think of as Israel, south of what we think of as Syria. They're called Phoenicians because they were very famous, among other things, for exporting purple dye, and the Romans, therefore, called them the Poeni, the purple people. But actually, in point of fact, they were Canaanites. Now, the Phoenicians emerged then along the what we would think of as the Lebanese coast. They built a series of very important trading cities like Tyre, Sidon.